Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, this is Lily Gorn with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today, I'm joined by Esther Dadao, and she is the author of Hot Pants and Spandex Suits, Gender Representation in American Superhero Comic Books. This is published in 2021 by Rutgers University Press, and it is a really interesting and complex analysis of what we see in comic books with regard to gender, with regard to race, with regard to othering. But I'm going to let Esther tell us a lot about that as we talk about her awesome book. Hi, Esther. Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
It's my pleasure. I wanted to ask you a little bit about yourself and how you came to this really fascinating project.
So the book is actually like a rewrite of my doctoral thesis. So I'm originally from Belgium, and I came to the UK to do my PhD on superheroes specifically. And it's a very classic story amongst comic scholars, which is that we started reading comics maybe a bit later in life than some fans. So during our masters, and you're thinking about research, exploring research. At the same time, you're tumbling into comics. You're getting into more and more different titles every month, and it kind of starts snowballing all together. And then you end up writing about comics. And writing about superheroes, and you end up doing a doctoral project on it. I think I very much came into it thinking, like, I really wanted to do my PhD on gender studies and thinking about othering and things like that. And when I was reading lots of comics at the time, it just felt a very natural kind of thing to just start writing about them. And then I started thinking more concretely about which superheroes I'd want to talk about specifically. And at the time that I was first envisioning this project, like the first Avengers film had come out. And so it was kind of really kicking off like Captain America and Iron Man as being the big names in Marvel comics. And so I kind of started there and then obviously ended on some of the big names in DC that have been popular for so long. So Superman, Wonder Woman, etc. The original project had a chapter on Batman in it that got dropped because I very quickly had my supervisor tell me, you're trying to do too much. There's too much in this project now. So yeah, that's kind of where it went. And then as I sort of finalized the chapters in terms of, I want to talk about gay superheroes as well. I want to talk about black superheroes as well. I then kind of naturally fell onto some popular and well-known superheroes like Storm, Black Panther, and then Batwoman at the time. That's kind of how it all kind of came together. And then I graduated, and then I spent 3 years turning it into a book that people could read.
As one does with the doctoral dissertation. I know that experience. But this is a really interesting book in terms of digging into these questions of representation in the comic books. And I wanted to ask you first to talk a little bit about how you're specifically focusing on the comic books themselves, and you make a case for this as opposed to a lot of the visual presentations in film and television. Can you explain why you narrowed it in on that particular focus, which is not narrow, but by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah. So it is kind of that thing where you do have to draw a line somewhere. I mean, ideally, I would have written on everything all at once. And there are books, a lot of books now that talk about specific characters and how they differ across comics, but also film. And those are some really interesting projects happening there. But I think for me, it was kind of, I had to draw a line, and I really wanted to focus on the specificity of comic books as a visual medium. And specifically because there's so much translation work that happens when you're changing something that is a book or a comic, and then you're changing that to, I don't know, like a film or a TV series. There's so much changing that needs to happen because you can't tell the same story in the same way. And so many TV and shows and films are seen as adaptations of the comic book. That was kind of really drawn to this comic book as kind of the origins of the superhero as a figure, and the massive impact that this has had on versions of the superhero in books and TV, of course. It's really interesting, and I kind of wish that I'd had the ability to incorporate a bit more on TV and films later down the line, because certainly from like the 1990s onwards, you've actually had the phenomenon where TV shows and films and books have started influencing the comics. So two very famous examples are Harley Quinn was originally a character in the Batman animated series. She wasn't added into the comics until she proved to be a very popular character in that series. And then Nick Fury used to be a Y character. And then when Samuel Jackson was cast, they changed him into a Black character in the comics. So there's lots of really fascinating communication now or interplay between these various mediums. But at the time when I was starting out, I was very much drawn to this idea of, comic books is where it all started. So that's where I want to start and kind of make my way through. So I do kind of reference TVs and films as is appropriate throughout the book. But yeah, I do very much try to keep that tight focus on comics because there is so much material there anyway. So even in comics, you have to make quite brutal cuts sometimes on what you can and cannot include.
And that was also one of my questions for you in terms of you sort of set up your research, or at least the book research, in a kind of case study method. And so you selected various comic superheroes to really draw your focus to. What was the reasoning to sort of make it into that kind of a case study method of analysis?
To be completely honest, like, because I could dress this up in very academic terms, of course, but to be completely honest, it's just because I wanted to talk about specific characters that I really liked reading, literally it. And then kind of the justification for that came after. But also to do the academic thing, I did pick case studies because I really wanted to kind of encompass a lot of time. So like if the start of comics is like the early 1940s, late 1930s, depending on who you pick as the defining start of superhero comics, until right up until now, that's 80 plus years. That's a really long stretch of time to be doing research on. So especially if you're then talking about comics in general, or even the superhero in general, the sheer amount of material that there would be. So again, you're making choices. I think for me, it was like, I want to be able to talk about this really long period, and I want to be able to do it in quite a focused way, and doing it through a specific character and watching how they specifically evolved, I thought would be really interesting, because the idea is that they still have to be superheroes. So what is it about them that makes them superheroes, even if they go through some changes that take them really far away from what people think of when they think of the superhero? So it's unfortunately something I had to cut from the book. But Wonder Woman went through a period in the 1960s and 1970s where she didn't wear the Wonder Woman costume and was mostly known as Diana Prince. And she was a detective who had a boutique, like a clothing shop. And that's like a really fabulous time. But then the question is, well, how is she still a superhero if she doesn't have her superpowers, doesn't have a costume, doesn't have her superhero code name? any of the things that make her a superhero. How is she still recognizably a superhero when she could just be an action hero or, you know, a spy or something like that? So for me, it kind of really went down into that kind of what makes the superhero a superhero. And what does that idea of the superhero then tell us about gender and race, or the other way around? Like, what do our ideas about gender and race tell us who a superhero is or what a superhero looks like? So yeah, that's kind of why I was like, one, I want to talk about these characters because I love reading them. But two, I also think that will give me kind of the best way of looking at a real evolution over time.
And in that context, I mean, you do basically say that there's a historical trajectory that transpires because of the way that comic books as a commodity operated, that they were very popular during the Second World War period, and then they sort of declined in popularity or people weren't buying them as much. And then they had, you know, a revival. What is it about the sort of early history in particular that these ages that sort of shapes at least some of the ideas with regard to the gender projections that we see in superheroes?
So I think it's like it's that thing where you can't separate the art or the storytelling from the commercial perspectives of the companies. So it's one of these things where you're constantly trying to appeal to an audience. So I think it's one of these things where, and especially during the Comic Code Authority time period, it's all about we need to appeal to the audience in the right way. And that means that we need to simultaneously regurgitate all the norms and values and gender roles that, you know, our mainstream audience desires. But then we might increasingly have a more vocal fan base that desires more progressive storylines. So we have to kind of be able to rope them in as well. So Adrienne Risher, and I hope I'm saying her name correctly, talks about this a little bit in her Blue Age of Comic Books work, which is all about the fact that we've entered a new age of comic books, which is dominated by the digital domain, not just through digital readers, but also through the fact that most fan communication now occurs online. And it's all about the cultural capital that something has. So like a really good example is Game of Thrones. Game of Thrones dominated online discourse for like ages. And then the ending was so bad that it basically vanished from cultural discourse. And companies generally couldn't unload all the merchandise they had for it. People just weren't buying it anymore. So cultural capital, its online presence is now a really important metric that companies use to invest in whatever. So when you then link that back to, you know, gender roles or progressive values or, you know, how we talk about race in this art specifically, you have to keep in mind that a lot of these companies are trying to simultaneously cater to perhaps a more old-fashioned traditional fan base and at the same time bring in this new vocal online fandom that is, you know, people who want more women, want more characters of color, want to see less sexism, less racism in the comic books. So there's that dichotomy, that tension that is kind of constantly at play. And you do see that's happened traditionally over the years as well in the past, especially in like, I think it was the 60s and 70s when I think it was, I can't remember his name now. But basically, an editor at DC started including addresses when fans sent in their letters, and the letters were then published in the back of the comic book. They would include letters, so fans started communicating with each other. And once that communication started getting going, that became a community. And then the community as a whole started communicating with the industry, with writers, with artists. And then from that, you have this new dialogue, you know, free market research. And a dialogue about what it is that fans really, really want. And kind of the online sphere is very similar to that now, where creators have a direct pipeline to what is it that fans want? And can we do that? Will the editors allow us to do that? Because at the end of the day, you know, Marvel still has to sign off on it. And Marvel is owned by the mouse now, or its studios are. And that means that the comics have to be a little bit careful about what they do because they're so closely linked now. They mutually influence each other.
So in terms of the fan bases that have, as you're talking about, sort of there's the catering to a more traditional, what might be considered a more traditional, more conservative fan base that expects, you know, Superman to act a super way, a particular way and look a particular way. And you talk about, you know, the sort of projection of this kind of white masculinity that comes through so much of the superheroes, particularly from the early times. How has that idea and ideal sort of continued to shape our understanding of who gets to be a superhero?
So I think for me, really, the key aspect of white masculinity is crisis. White masculinity is always in crisis. There is a constant ongoing fear that men aren't manly enough anymore, that the gains made by other demographics in society are reducing the white man's status, or whatever, that the sons are not as hardy and as strong as the fathers. That is a continuous thing that you see throughout. You know, during the Cold War, you know, people were worried that, oh, I'm not masculine enough because I've got an office job, but my father fought in World War II. And then in the 60s, it was like, oh, my son's a hippie. He didn't have an office job like I had. He didn't provide for his family like I have. So there's this constant, you know, worry and fear that the next generation is softer than the one before. And so our heroes are kind of, our superheroes especially, are kind of an antidote to that. They're all about, you know, hardiness, strength. And that's why they're super, because it's blown up, it's disproportionate. Like, no real man has Superman's abilities. So there's that moment of crisis can be assuaged, forgotten. It can be left behind because he is, you know, beyond comparison. And that's kind of what these superheroes really project, you know, this kind of amazing beyond the pale ability. And in terms of masculinity, it is then about the ultra masculine man. No one can ever beat him. No one will ever be stronger than him. He always comes out on top. He stands for all those values that we associate with masculinity: self-reliance, hardiness, honor, etc., etc. So it's kind of really the projection of this kind of white masculinity that is idealized and super powerful and, you know, taken to extremes, really, really toxic to people as well.
And one of the points that you make, and I've seen this analysis in a couple of other places as well, is that because the initial writers of the Superman comic books were essentially Jewish immigrants to the United States, that they were also trying to communicate a kind of expanded whiteness in the superheroes. Can you explain how that is presented?
So it's kind of, it's one of the things where, so Superman as an example, he's quite far divorced from his Jewish origins, and he never really had, Superman himself was never Jewish. It's a tricky question that you've asked me there. So I will do my very best to kind of elaborate. But it's essentially, the idea is that white passing throughout the years became the most important signifier of whiteness, and through that, white masculinity. Right. So it's all about the what is sometimes called the racial bribe, or the sexuality bribe, which is, as long as you can pass convincingly enough as this one category, we won't treat you as what you actually are, which is this other category, which sounds really horrible. That's essentially kind of what happens. So it's like, years and years and years ago, Irish people, for instance, weren't considered white, and Jewish people weren't considered white. But a lot of the time now, if you are phenotypically, in appearance-wise, white, people won't question that. And so whiteness is now very much no longer associated with Anglo-Saxon or Germanic ancestry. It is now associated with a phenotypically white appearance. And it's kind of something that's happening now in what we see in a lot of online communities in regards to the sexual bribe, which is refer to as the pink washing of white nationalism, which is that if you are a white gay man, you can temporarily buy into these extreme right-wing circles by punching down on other categories or other demographics. So, you know, black people or people with from Arabic descent, Jewish people, etc. So it's this kind of, you sacrifice a part of yourself, or a part of yourself is made invisible because you've chosen to punch down on a more visible other. And it's that punching down that will buy you acceptance into this group. And the horrible thing is, of course, that acceptance is always temporary, but in the moment, it doesn't appear that way. But it is temporary. And those groups will always inevitably other you again later down the line. But so to bring that back to kind of to Superman, Superman was kind of part of a wave of popular figures who helped that kind of transition from Anglo-Saxon Germanic ancestry to phenotypically white appearance that really kind of happened during World War II, because it was very much this kind of, the idea of the American melting pot came to the fore. We're all white Americans. So our racism is good and decent, but Germany's racism is horrible and bad. And it's that kind of, the tension between those two things kind of setting off that change and that evolution of looking as us, as together we're all white, and not necessarily focusing on that ancestry element in quite the same way.
And so in terms of the way that you trace this through the book, you start off with a discussion of white superheroes and masculinity, some of which we just talked about. But then you transition to the white female body as the next sort of case study in looking at the transition from the male to the female in comic books. Can you talk a little bit about what you saw in terms of looking at the females in comics, particularly, obviously, the projection of white female bodies?
So it's a thing that, like, white femininity, because of its whiteness, can afford to be less traditionally feminine than other women. And you kind of see that happening now in, so I think it was over the Olympics that quite a lot of black women were targeted and had to produce certificates for the level of hormones they were producing. That's kind of like a real world impact of that kind of visual dialogue where white women, because of their whiteness, are always seen as more female than other women. And so, like, but to bring that back to superheroes, so most female superheroes, including the white female superheroes, always are visually very traditionally feminine a lot of the time. So they're very slim. They might be big-breasted, but they're very slim. Beautifully coiffed hair, makeup, all that. They're always drawn very alluring. And it's not until later on that sexualization kind of drops down. So you have, for instance, Gail Simone's Wonder Woman. So Gail Simone's the writer in this instance, not the artist. But the artist that she works with often depicted Wonder Woman as very muscular in that in those comics. So it's one of these things where the muscularity, in a way, is transgressive, because we still associate muscularity with masculinity, not just with strength. It's a physically powerful body, and that's usually missing from female superheroes. They have what is referred to as pose and point powers. You know, they strike a very alluring, sexy pose, and then something happens in the distance, and oh my God, they're so powerful. But they're never physically in the combat. They're not getting dirty. They're not getting bloody. They're not punching someone's face in. That's not feminine, so they don't do that. And of course, in the 80s, with the rise of the, you know, bodybuilding action heroes, we did have in wider popular culture more, you know, physically combative female action heroes, like, you know, Sigourney Weaver in the Alien films and Laura Connor in the Terminator films, the second one at least. So that kind of became a thing, and that also happened in comics as well. So physical violence against women became more common in the 80s. And so physical body types are a little bit more diverse now. So you do sometimes have a very, you know, muscular Wonder Woman. You can have muscular other characters as well. But that's mostly still very much white female superheroes. You don't have that for black or Arab superheroes quite as much, because it's still very much a visual medium that is catering to an audience, and that audience is still understood to be, you know, straight white boys. Whether that's actually true or not is a different discussion, but certainly culturally we think of comic book audience as a white straight boys club. So there is very much still that pressure to depict women as, you know, very sexy and alluring, and not necessarily as someone who's super hench, who can and will punch your lights out. That's not necessarily what I'm sure some men do find that attractive, but, you know, maybe not traditionally considered to be a money-making thing to do.
And they may also feel like that's going to be a threat, obviously.
You can't have a female superhero who's so buff that she looks like she could intimidate the male superheroes. You can't have that. Wonder Woman can, but she's the exception, because when she does it, it's sexy, but no one else can. That's the rule.
And I understand, as my own research tends to be in film and television, but the rendering in film and television of the action by many of the female superheroes is off screen. You often see the result of that, but you don't actually see it the same way that you do see Iron Man or Captain America getting into it with others in a face to face and fist to fist combat. So the translation is sort of very much present from comics to the film adaptations.
That's why the Batwoman comic, when it was written by Greg Rucka and his creative team, so interesting, because you had panels and close-ups of Kate's Batwoman's face when she was working out, and she'd be like really like grr, getting in there, bared teeth, scrunching up her face. You'd see her get hit, you'd see her get bloody, and there was that kind of very and almost like really appealing physicality to it. But then it was also like, yeah, but she's a lesbian. So does that mean she's allowed? Is that like this kind of weird stereotype coming to the fore? And on the other hand, are we over policing that because it is a lesbian character? So we're looking at her, we have much more expectations of her, of what she needs to do as a character. So, yeah.
And you also take up it. So it's not just the gender representation that you take up in this book with regard to male and female, but you also spend a lot of time discussing the LGBTQ integration over time, shall we say, of characters in the comic books who are not necessarily straight and white, but certainly not necessarily straight. How did these characters sort of come along? You know, what was the impetus that the comic writers sort of said, oh, we actually need a gay character?
So I think I will definitely bring this back to fan engagement. So very much so, you know, the stories that fans demand that are written, that they want to read. Because I think it's one of these things where, especially in the 60s and 70s, when the Comics Code Authority was kind of like losing its power. And that was partly because fans were coming out and saying, but I want to read something that is weird and radical. Violent, sure, because that's the medium that we're in. But also something that really, you know, pushes past these boundaries that have been put on us. So I think that's kind of a lot of where we're initially started. And also there is, of course, the prestige of being able to say, oh, but we did the first gay character, you know. So once it kind of became more addressed in mainstream media, that kind of opened the doors for comics to start doing it. Because of the CCA, they kind of had to wait for social norms to shift before they could get in there. And then now as well, I think a lot of online fan engagement is pushing that drive to, we want to do more, we want to see more. So I think that's kind of very much the case there. And I think certainly with Batwoman, there was very much the promotional material very much promised, oh, you know, we've got a character. She's going to join our A-list. You know, this isn't someone who's going to be lounging in the B-list like The Question or Green Arrow. I'm going to have some angry Green Arrow fans writing to me about putting him in the B-list. But, you know, she's going to be up there with Superman and Batman and she's going to be amazing. And she's a lesbian. Oh, my God, look at us. Look at how progressive we are. And then the Justice League title she was going to join wasn't a title. It became a miniseries. And then it kind of, like, not the reverse of snowballed, basically. It kind of lost momentum. So I think there's definitely that kind of prestige impulse there as well. Like, oh, we were the first. We have this. Look at what we're doing. Look at what Marvel's not doing, basically. So this kind of, like being able to say, we did it first, because there is such an obsession with history and record keeping and continuity keeping within the community. It's that collector's mindset. So, you know, the very much financial impetus of people buying a comic, because then they can say, oh, but I had the very first issue of this very first gay character that DC ever did, you know. So there's that aspect to consider as well. But I also think that, yeah, and to go back to it is just fan engagement, I think, a lot of the time, because you do have creators who come out and say, oh, but this character is gay. It wasn't addressed in the comic. There wasn't the space for that, but this character is gay. And that's usually through a conversation with fans at a convention or with an interview that comes out. So it's very much this kind of, there is a thirst in fandom for these stories, and there is a financial element that comes into play as well. So, yeah.
And you've mentioned this a couple times, and I learned about this from your book in particular. The CCA is a body that was created to sort of keep us safe from comics. And not everybody is aware of this body. Could you explain a little bit about it and how it got here and what's it doing now?
So it's basically like back in the 1940s, right? So comics become really, really popular. Great. Their content is also becoming increasingly violent. Parents start picking up on this. So back in 1948, the comics industry is like, all right, yeah, we're going to set up a little code. We're going to do some self-regulating as an industry. And then that immediately failed, because there were no real consequences attached to breaking any of these regulations they were trying to set up. But it was kind of already too late as well, because at the same time, there was a huge moral panic about the state of children in America. So this kind of thing, like, their parents had been away to fight at war during some of their formative years. So these were very independent adolescents and children. And there was a genuine moral panic about, like, juvenile crime. So the facts show that there actually wasn't a rise in the actual amount of juvenile crime that was occurring. There was a rise in the brutality and severity of the few cases of juvenile crimes there were, but there wasn't like a wave of juvenile panic overtaking the nation. But if you listened to the news or read the newspaper, you would think that there was. You'd think that, you know, there were, you know, girls of 14 having children everywhere and boys of 15 stabbing anyone who looked at them funny. That's what you would think. So enter Frederick Wortham, who is a child psychologist. And he very much gets painted as a villain in like comic study circles a little bit. But he genuinely was very concerned with, you know, children's health. And the exposure to mass media in general, so not just comic books, he was genuinely concerned about the racism, sexism, and violence that children and adolescents were constantly being exposed to through mass media. So comics were a really easy target because they were already part of the national conversation because parents had so little control over comics. You know, they were extremely cheap. Children would buy them with their own pocket money, take them to school and swap them. So adults really didn't have any kind of control over that in their children's lives. And so that kind of created this perfect storm. So he starts campaigning to get comic books banned. There's a Senate committee on juvenile crime in the 1950s where Frederick Wortham and some comic book industry professionals testify. The Senate committee concludes that actually comic books are not directly responsible for the rise in crime, but it heavily implies that it's, you know, a contributing factor. So people everywhere start banning comic books. And of course, you know, that gets challenged in court. It's not constitutional, et cetera, et cetera. So these fail. But there's book burnings of comic books happening everywhere. Church groups are organizing mass burnings of comic books and things like that. So the industry basically caves and says, all right, we've got to do something about this. And they form the Comics Code Authority. And yeah, that's kind of how it came to be. And it controlled and very strongly controlled the industry for quite a long time. And it determined the kind of nudity you could show, which was none. The gender roles you could show, which was traditional. The treatment of characters who weren't white had to be respectfully, but that kind of white anxiety about even depicting racism meant that, you know, characters of any color and that wasn't white just got dropped immediately. Because even storylines trying to, you know, discuss racism and show its evils were rejected by the Comics Code Authority. And it was a real expensive process to go through because you had to pay a membership fee yearly and you had to pay a submission fee every single time you submitted a comic for approval. And they could send it back with revisions. And basically, if you then had to end up spending a lot of time revising, if you had to go through that process several times, it could mean that you missed the publication date for that specific issue, which meant that you couldn't charge your advertisement spaces at full rate. And so several like small-time comic book production companies folded in that environment. And you couldn't really circumvent the CCA because they give you a stamp of approval. And lots of retailers refused to stack shelves with issues that didn't have that stamp of approval. So they kind of really had them in a chokehold. And there were only a few comic book producers like Dell. They had a line of educational comics and they were like, oh, no, we've always been very, very nice and very much above reproach. And I'm not going to associate my brand with your disreputable brand by going through the CCA. So they could kind of afford to do that, but most comic book companies couldn't. And EC folded as a result. And I think they're the ones who then ended up doing Mad Magazine. And that's kind of their villain origin story, as it were, because they got destroyed by the CCA.
And the CCA, though, as you note in the book, has sort of declined in regard to its authority and kind of doesn't really operate anymore.
I mean, I couldn't tell you if they still existed. I probably did Google it at the time that I published the book, but I couldn't tell you now. Because they don't really matter anymore. No one has the stamp anymore. No one has to do it anymore and I think they kind of really stopped operating at the late 80s, early 90s, because not only were societal mores changed to such an extent that there really wasn't that kind of panic about, you know, violence in comic books anymore, but also you had the direct market. So you had comic book shops that specialized in just having comic books. And they wouldn't refuse to carry stuff without the CCA because most of these shops were owned by fans who wanted the more gruesome stuff in the first place, you know? It was kind of, the CCA kind of got its legs swept out from under them and just didn't have the same power that they used to because of changing social mores and then the direct market. And then even after the direct market kind of collapsed, they just didn't get their power back. And I don't know if they're still operational at the moment.
But they're not really relevant. So.
No, so yeah, I guess they just, you can ignore them if you should wish to, yes.
One of the things that you talk about that they do is not only are they eliminating any like forms of nudity or sort of even discussions of racism, is that they also are really kind of narrowing the scope for the activities that women can have in the comics. I mean, they are still superheroes, but in their alter ego lives that they are supposed to be very traditional. How does that sort itself out within the narrative storylines of the comics that are written?
So a really good example, I think, would be Sue Storm from the Fantastic Four. So she's a superhero, but she's very much framed as being the mom of the team, you know? So she fulfills that very traditional role. And she's also very often overcome by her powers and kind of passes out or faints because she's extended them too far. Or you have Supergirl, who has a string of boyfriends, nothing ever too racy, has lots of magical adventures, but she's never fully in control of her powers. She needs her cousin Superman to come help her out. She's just a teenager, really. And so it's that kind of making sure that women are framed within that traditional kind of role, and it kind of negates the transgression of their superhero abilities. So let's take Wonder Woman, for instance, because it's hard to imagine Wonder Woman as being put into one of those roles because she's Wonder Woman. But in the 1950s, like, her obsession with Steve Trevor was never as great as it was back then. And this constant, like, oh, but what if he likes Diana Prince more than he likes Wonder Woman? How dare he? But you are Diana Prince, though. That's you. What is that? So this kind of threesome, women can't be friends with each other to the extent that they're even jealous of their own alter ego. Or they would do these storylines where through the magical machinery of Paradise Island, where all the Amazons live, you have Wonder Woman and then herself from when she was a baby, Wonder Tot, and then herself when she was like a child slash semi-teenager, Wonder Girl, and then her mum, Queen Hippolyta, and they would all come together to fight whatever was threatening them on the day. So it was very much just, oh, it's the family coming together, these marvelous women coming together to save the day. And yeah, so it was kind of this, under the guise of fantastical and whimsy-like storylines, you'd have these kind of consistent messaging of women are just girls, really, or women are just mothers, really. Or, you know, it doesn't matter that you have superheroes, you still have to babysit your own self from when you were a baby because that's just your natural caregiving role. There's a really great one where Steve Trevor has a dream, and you don't realize he's having the dream until, like, the comic, at the end of the comic. But basically in it, he finally convinces Wonder Woman to marry him. And it's one of these things where they bump into a couple on the way to the ceremony. So and they're trying to get married, but calamity has overtaken them. So Diana gives them her dress. And then they, on the way to their honeymoon, they bump into a couple who've crashed their car. So Diana gives them the car. And then Diana is like, oh, I'll make us a dinner. You just relax now that we're finally here. And then he comes out and turns out she doesn't know how to cook because she's lived on Paradise Island and been a Wonder Woman all this time. So it's kind of this horrible nightmare that Steve Trevor has that's played off for laughs about how horrible a wife she would be. And that kind of helps sustain the tension of, oh, but I can't marry you, Steve. I can't marry you until I've, you know, changed the world, until I've fulfilled all my duties as Wonder Woman. And this kind of funny issue actually kind of goes, well, actually, yeah, she's never going to marry him because, one, her duties as Wonder Woman will never end. But also, she would actually be a terrible wife. Like, the fear and the horror of that is kind of part of that 1950 storyline.
And Wonder Woman fighting with Diana Prince I over Steve Trevor also, I think, would fail the Bechdel test, wouldn't it?
It would. It would, for sure. I don't think any of the 1950s Wonder Woman stories passed the Bechdel test. Maybe when the Holiday Girls. So basically, Diana's like the chancellor or like the nominary president of like the sorority called the Holiday Girls. It's the first, it's where Etta Candy got created as a character. And so some of that is about them, you know, oh, it's just good, wholesome fun. And we're going to, me, Wonder Woman, we're going to show you guys how to exercise. It's important to maintain your figure. So I guess that technically would pass the Bechdel test. But like, certainly not in the spirit that the test was created.
And the last case study that you pay attention to, which is more about obviously race than it is about gender, but it is, you know, sort of the way that the comic books have created this the stereotype of the male, the white male, and then everybody is a kind of other from it. And you talk a lot about how the presentation of the of Black superheroes, particularly Black Panther and Wakanda, is still from a white perspective. And so can you explain a little bit about what you saw in terms of that particular case study and how it's, you know, fitting into this broader picture of the representation within the superhero comics?
So Black Panther really was kind of created to with this idea of presenting Blackness like outside of whiteness, because he's from a country that was never colonized, etc. But Martin Lund, I think it was, did an excellent analysis of like the introductory issue of Black Panther, where the Fantastic Four first go to Wakanda, and they very much describe it as like being on a Hollywood set. So there's this kind of Wakanda as supposedly being a supremely advanced nation, still being described in terms of savagery and exoticism, and yet at the same time, extremely technologically advanced. So this idea of, you know, technology being the end all be all of all progress, really. So it's kind of very Western idea of what it means to be an advanced civilization, which is access to consumer technology, probably. So you have that kind of image of Wakanda and Black Panther as being its leader. And I think the issue that I have with Black Panther is that a lot of the time you see him divorced from Wakanda. A lot of the comics actually take him out of Wakanda, and he's meant to be their king, their sovereign. He's meant to fight for their civil rights. And certainly at times he does fight and represent Wakandan interests abroad, for sure. But a lot of the comics that I've read very much talk about the tension between, oh, but all his friends are the Avengers, so they're all these white Americans. He's just constantly hanging out with these white Americans. And he's torn between the demands of his nation and like, oh, but my friend Captain America said it was cool, so I don't know why you guys aren't thrilled about this development. So there's that tension where true good, the objective good in comics, is mostly almost always aligned with white masculinity. The white male hero determines what is good, what is right. And very often that is the defense of the status quo. And we live in a racist world. And so if you have a hero who's defending the status quo, he's basically defending the way that the racist world works and operates. So if you put a Black character in there who also is meant to be a superhero and therefore also aligned with the comics idea of objective good, which is defending the status quo, it's very hard to portray a Black character who is truly fighting for Black people's best interests, or in Black Panther's case, Wakandan interests. Because to fight for Wakandan interests would inevitably put him in opposition to the white male superhero, and therefore cast him as the villain, because a lot of comic books don't allow for a more nuanced take on morals than Black, you know, Black versus white, good versus white, that kind of thing. So it's really difficult, I think, for Black superheroes to be seen as, oh, I can't remember who coined it now, but this idea of the real Black superhero is someone who campaigns for his people's best interests against the status quo. And therefore, are any of the Black superheroes that we have real Black superheroes? That's kind of the question. And it's, I think it's one of these things where the more you have a creative team that is very in touch with these issues, and therefore the more diverse your creative team is, if you give Black people a voice and, you know, well, no, they have a voice. If you give Black people a platform and control over this Black superhero, the more likely you are to have a more authentic story that kind of does talk about these things more, about what it means to be a Black superhero in our very kind of white world. And it's very difficult then to assert a very powerful Black masculinity because we have defined masculinity as the person who's always on top, but because we've also defined that as white masculinity, the black male superhero kind of will always, within the comic's internal logic, fall underneath that. So there's that constant struggle of, we want to make a superhero who is black. That's great. That's perfect. But the gender roles and the racial structure that we have created within the comic kind of doesn't allow for that, because we put the male white superhero at the very top of the hierarchy. So it's that constant tension, that constant battle.
The patriarchy goes on, is still there.
Exactly. And it's very hard to create something that can be completely disconnected from that pre-existing structure, you know?
I have one question that I really want to hear from you on. You said that you started this as your dissertation and you were interested in gender studies, but you specifically then wanted to do work on comics. What did you find in your research that really surprised you?
Something that really surprised me. Gosh, I feel, oh, it's been so long now. But I think what really surprised me was actually, and I will admit to this, is the sheer amount of black superheroes that actually are out there. And I think it's one of the things where I just didn't have any attention for it prior to my research. I wasn't paying attention to it. It wasn't something that was on my radar. And then I started doing research into it. And there are so many, and so many that actually have had a real lasting impact on the genre and that have since faded into obscurity. So during the popularity of the blaxploitation era, you actually had loads of black superhero characters. And some of them have been kind of recovered, like Luke Cage, but others have just kind of completely vanished. But there were and are so many more out there, and they were politically significant. They were significant to the industry, but they've kind of just vanished. And you have a lot of scholars now doing the very important work of excavating these heroes and talking about them, writing about them, which is really good. But that was something that really surprised me. And what also really surprised me, actually, was that Wonder Woman is not the first female superhero, actually. Miss Fury is technically the first female superhero. She was, I think I've talked about this in the introduction, why I then paid attention to Wonder Woman instead of Miss Fury, which is that Miss Fury was a strip in a newspaper and Wonder Woman was like an actual comic book. So it's like syndicated strip versus comic books. But syndication strips is where all superheroes originated, really. But yeah, basically Wonder Woman was not the very first female superhero, and that really surprised me as well, because I didn't know that.
So what are you working on now?
I'm actually like on my way out of academia, unfortunately. Yeah, I tried for a few years, but I actually haven't had an academic position since I stopped teaching as part of my PhD. It's just a very hard industry to break through in. And I've had most of my cohort actually have left, either because they wanted to or because they couldn't get through. And so I think like the latest project that I had in mind, I actually wanted to talk about medical apartheid and how that influences ideas in superhero comic books. So this idea of the medical industry and how it has treated black people as if they don't have proper ownership over their own bodies, and how we see in comics that we have several black superheroes who have had, you know, illegal experimentation done on them that they didn't give consent to, etc. So I kind of wanted to dig into that more, but I couldn't get the funding. So unfortunately, I might come back to it after a little break, but at the moment I'm not really working on anything.
Well, I do hope that you come back to it, because you are clearly a very committed and expert researcher of this field, and I look forward to reading more of your work. It's been a pleasure to speak with you, Esther. I really enjoyed this book and our conversation. So thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's actually been really fun to dig back into the book, because you know when you finish a book, you're like, I can't look at it anymore. So it's actually been really fun to kind of go back, and I had to reread bits of it in preparation for this. It's actually been really fun to come back to it again.
Well, I have been joined by Esther Dudow, the author of Hot Pants and Spandex Suits, Gender Representation in American Superhero Comic Books, published by Rutgers University Press in 2021. Available, I am sure, at the Rutgers University Press website, right?
Yes, yes. And Amazon.
Don't say
it. It is there as well. No, sorry. Just cut that. The Waterstones website, if you have Waterstones in America, the Waterstones website.
Or your favorite independent bookseller online.
Yes.
Very true. Thank you for joining me today, Esther. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.